there was an enormous football-shaped glowing object hovering a very short distance above the ground.
It got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the next thing we knew, it was right over us, you know. And the light was so bright, you know, and then it stopped at treetop level.
I thought it was doomsday. I really did. I didn't know what to expect after seeing two more in the field across from my house. I didn't know if it was an invasion or what.
A hatch opened up from the underside of the craft. A tube came down. And a platform slid down. So this being comes down and walks over to the front of the patrol car.
They were bald, no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes, and no earlobes, no ear, you know, we could say. Very large eyes, very small, flat nose, thin slit for mouth.
I saw this thing and I just came unglued.
Since 1947, thousands of people around the world have become more and more aware of a bizarre phenomenon we have come to know as unidentified flying objects. UFO encounters have been reported by citizens in all walks of life, including the President of the United States, Jimmy Carter.
There were about 20 of us standing outside of a little restaurant, I believe, a high school lunchroom, and a kind of a green light appeared in the western sky. This was right after sundown. And it got brighter and brighter, and then eventually it disappeared. It was not, didn't have any solid substance to it. It was just a very peculiar-looking light. None of us could understand what it was. I've never made fun of people who've seen other things of that kind.
Years have passed since the widespread UFO sightings of the post-World War II era, and yet the phenomenon is still very much with us. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, acknowledged to be the world's foremost authority on UFOs, has been investigating this enigma since 1948 as a consultant to the Air Force and since 1973 as the founder and director of the Center for UFO Studies in Evanston, Illinois. Investigative Research Associates has been proud to have Dr. Hynek direct this project to prepare the first completely factual documentary on UFOs.
The UFO phenomenon is truly a phenomenon of our times. It is an extremely puzzling one and calls forth a wide spectrum of opinions. No matter what one may think about UFOs, no matter what one may believe about them, whether it is all nonsense or whether they represent something very, very real, three facts stand out, three facts which no one can deny. The first is that UFO reports exist. Secondly, that UFO reports come from all over the world. And the third is that many are made by highly responsible people, often scientifically trained. We scientists have no positive proof yet of the origin or even of the reality of these strange reported craft. But we do know that the reports themselves are very real. To find the answer to this magnificent scientific puzzle, the UFO phenomenon, we need to approach it with a truly open mind so we can explore all possible avenues of explanation. This record will allow you to hear the actual witnesses describe their UFO encounters, to listen to the experts give their opinions, and to explain their hypotheses, and to allow you to make your own decision. In the final analysis, you must be the judge. Are we alone?
UFO sightings can be traced to biblical times, at least according to some interpretations of the writings of the prophet Ezekiel and his flying wheel. Ancient cave drawings of strange flying craft have been discovered by archaeologists. Rumors and legends of UFOs persisted throughout the Middle Ages, and the famous 18th century poet Goethe even included a report of his personal UFO sighting in his autobiography. Waves of UFO sightings were reported in the press during the latter 19th and early 20th centuries, but few have taken the phenomenon seriously. The first official United States investigation of UFOs began in 1943, when World War II pilots began relating tales of fiery objects in the night sky, moving at tremendous speeds, even pacing their own aircraft for miles. Military flyers in the European theater termed them Foo Fighters, Foo being the French word for fire. Now retired Air Force Major Paul Duitch describes an encounter his crew had over Japan.
The particular one that my crew saw was an orange-red color, and it paced our aircraft for miles and miles off the left horizontal stabilizer. We don't know how far off. It's very difficult to determine. This was a night raid. Everything was blackness all around us, except the fires burning down below. And we were on a bomb run into Sasebo, Japan. And so the top gunner, who had control of all the guns in the back of this B-29 bomber, fired a burst. The tracers were seen to go directly toward it, but nothing happened. And then after a short period of time, this thing detached itself from the position it held and made a kind of a diving, sweeping movement, which took it under our aircraft and off to the right and forward so that we up front could see it. And it's at that time that I saw it. And it was just a big blob of, in terms today, we'd probably call it ionized gas. It ran shivers up and down our spines. We thought it was a Japanese secret device, probably developed by the Germans. And I might add that the fellows over in the European theater thought it was a German device, and the Germans thought it was an Allied secret weapon, and everybody thought it was somebody else's. No one knew what it was.
Post-war conferences confirmed the mystery of the Foo Fighters. They were no one's secret weapon. The first of several waves of UFO sightings by the general public began in Sweden during the summer of 1946. On June 24, 1947, an experienced search and rescue pilot named Kenneth Arnold took off from a small airstrip in Chehalis, Washington, on a search for the wreckage of a missing C-46 military transport plane said to have gone down in the rough terrain of Mount Rainier with 32 Marines on board.
I had reached the altitude of about 9,200 feet when a very brilliant flash lit the sky around me and actually lit up the airplane that I was flying. And I could see way off to the right, coming in the vicinity of Mount Baker, a whole chain-like string of of aircraft coming at a tremendous speed. I could see plainly that they didn't have any tails. I had never seen aircraft of that kind. And I made a quick judgment that they must be approximately 100 foot in their wingspan. And the first unit or first craft flew at a higher altitude than the last. And of course, this is completely reversed from our normal flight patterns. I had a good fix with Mount Adams, and I thought I'd try to clock their speed between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. Pretty soon they approached Mount Adams. I got a good look at them. One particularly, the second from the last one, seemed a little larger and had a definite wraith-like shape, though, however, when they were flashing and flipping, they seemed circular. But as they left the southernmost ridge of Mount Adams, I looked at my sweep second hand, and they had covered that distance, which is approximately 50 miles, in a minute and 42 seconds.
Arnold calculated the speed of the craft at an astounding 1,700 miles per hour. He abandoned his search for the military wreckage and flew on to Pendleton, Oregon, where he reported what he had seen to the Air Force. Arnold didn't think the objects he had seen were extraterrestrial craft, despite press accounts which labeled them as such. Ironically, however, it was Arnold himself who was responsible for the development of the two words which are still used to describe the phenomenon.
Bill Brachette, who was a United Press reporter, he asked me, he said, well, how did they fly? And so I told him, I says, well, they flew very erratically, like boats on rough water, or I said, they would skip and sail and give off these flashes. And I said, or they could fly, I could say, maybe you take a saucer and you skip it across the water, and it's erratic. And this is how the name Flying Saucer was born. However, I did not say they were saucer-shaped.
The spectacular Arnold sighting and thousands of subsequent UFO reports led the Central Intelligence Agency to convene a top-secret scientific panel chaired by Dr. H.P. Robertson, noted scientist and relativity expert. The Robertson panel's conclusion? That UFO reports were more dangerous to national security than the unlikely existence of purported extraterrestrial craft. The findings of the Robertson panel greatly influenced the Air Force's Project Blue Book, which was created to make official probes into UFO incidents. Dr. J. Allen Hynek was Blue Book's scientific advisor.
Project Blue Book largely operated under the theorem, you might say, it can't be, therefore it isn't. They would, for instance, talk about certain cases being possible balloons, possible aircraft, possible stars. And at the end, when they made up the statistics at the end of the year, all those little words of possible and probable were dropped. But never once did they call a case a possible or probable UFO. There couldn't be such things as UFOs, therefore there couldn't be a possible UFO. Despite that, there were nearly 700 cases which remained unexplained.
Colonel Robert Friend, who directed Project Blue Book from 1958 to 1963, has this to add.
I believe that there is room for further pursuit. While I was conducting that program, I guess that I thought constantly of what I should do in investigating, or exactly how I should react, for instance, if I was to come, say, face to face with some being. I wouldn't really know how to act. And the other thing is that when I read today where people say that, there's no evidence, okay, and that doesn't necessarily mean that there was not evidence there. What it means is that those of us who investigated the things may not have had what it took at that time to recognize it.
In 1966, the government set up a Blue Ribbon Scientific Committee to study the Enigma. 2 years later, its chairman, Dr. Edward Condon, professor of physics at the University of Colorado, issued his summary stating that UFOs merited no further governmental attention. This despite the fact that the Condon report itself failed to explain more than a quarter of the cases it examined. Nevertheless, that study led to the official termination of government involvement in UFO research. By far the most sensational UFO incidents are those known as close encounter cases. Dr. Hynek has divided them into three categories.
Close encounters of the first kind are close, sufficiently close, say about 500 feet or less, sometimes very much less, so close that there's no question about the person seeing details on it, the portholes or lights or markings or protrusions. In other words, so that there's virtually no chance of a close encounter having been the result of seeing Venus or seeing a twinkling star.
On a clear, warm summer night, just north of Los Angeles, in the small community of Simi Valley, California, police officer Melvin Stewart was casually patrolling in his cruiser. It was Saturday evening, August 13, 1977. The sun had just dipped below the horizon when Officer Stewart's attention was caught by a strange light in the still darkening sky.
I was on patrol, working as a plainclothes unit, which is an unmarked car. And about 9 o'clock, or around about that time, I observed a what appeared to be an aircraft having problems coming towards me. I was driving eastbound on Los Angeles Avenue, and I observed what appeared to be an aircraft having problems dropping fiery, like molten metal or whatever, from it. And the molten metal was dissipating, the heat was dissipating before it hit the ground. There was a lot of light coming from, almost like an aircraft landing light. I didn't see any marking lights on it, but just a bright light and then this orangey flame. And then it lost sight of it, as if it crashed. And I put a broadcast out to the possible aircraft down in the area of the Simi Valley Airport. We checked the area and found nothing.
Almost simultaneously, Simi Valley Administrative Assistant Bob Hunt was driving in his car.
We were coming home from dinner over in the San Fernando Valley and coming on the Simi Valley Freeway and reached the crest, which is the county line right at the top, and noticed what I thought to be an airplane in the top left-hand corner of the windshield. It had blue and red lights, which was pretty common for an aircraft, and I really didn't pay it all that much attention to it, feeling that it was that, and was to continue the conversation with the people I had in the car. And as it reached about the middle of what was our windshield, I noticed that it dropped dramatically. Now, I can't really say how far it dropped, but I know it went from approximately the top of the windshield to the bottom of it in a matter of, well, faster than you could blink an eye. And the bottom, when it dropped like it did, it suddenly did an unusual loop at the bottom. And that obviously, coupled with the drop, caught my attention. It seemed to hover for a matter of maybe 1 or 2 seconds, and then was out of sight within 2 or 3 seconds, which was a lot faster than it had been traveling originally. And that right there made me cause to stop and think perhaps it was not an aircraft after all.
Nearly an hour later, two police cars were dispatched to investigate reports of an unusual object hovering less than 200 feet over the intersection of Los Angeles Avenue and Airedale Street. A short chase ensued to the freeway interchange, at which time other police officers arrived on the scene, including policewoman Linda Nesbitt.
The UFO, once it reached the area of 118, which is a freeway, and First Street, it ascended. And it did so with great speed, more than you would envision the norm. And it remained stationary for great periods of time, longer than I would ever envision a helicopter or anything of that nature staying stationary. We were using our red lights and our aircraft landing lights, which is a spotlight, and pointing them or directing them at the UFO. And it was reacting to it audibly on occasion, and it did make a movement towards the lights. As we turned the light off, then it would return to its original position and remain stationary again. But it was reactive to the lights, which seemed unusual to me.
Minutes later, Officer Stewart arrived and confirmed that it was the same object he had seen earlier. Officer Nesbitt remembers the sound the craft made as it moved overhead.
It wasn't a whoosh or anything like that. It was, I guess you would have to describe it as kind of a hum, beepy, like the conventional noises that you would associate with a craft in a movie. Really, it was. That's the kind of noise it was. But it was very distant.
September 9th is a date Bill Pecka will never forget. It's his wife Linda's birthday. And September 9th, 1976, was the day of Bill Pecka's close encounter with a UFO. The Peckas live on a farm just outside Colusa, California, about 100 miles north of San Francisco. That evening, Bill had been up late, having come home from town after buying Linda a birthday present, and then doing some welding in the auto shop behind his house. Around 11 o'clock, Bill went inside to watch the late movie on television. The TV Western was interrupted by an experience even stranger than fiction.
I was watching this Western movie, and the TV really messed up. And then it went out. So I was laying on the couch there, and I looked out the window of the shop to see if the nightlight was on, and it wasn't. So I thought maybe I might have blown a fuse in the shop. So I was going to just go out and check things out until I went out the door, and I felt quite a bit of electrical shock, a tingle. And I looked up, and this is when I seen the huge object above my house and over parts of the barn. I judged it to be at least 150 feet across it. It was saucer shape with a high dome. It was very shiny underneath. It was a porcelain-type finish. And I was getting a tremendous shock all over my whole body. My hair was standing up, and I had electrical static feeling over my hair on my arms and my head. And as it moved out over the field, I could start seeing more portions of the top half, which was dome shape, and concaves on the side of the dome, sort of like a lemon squeezer. And as it went out over the field very quietly, which is probably about 50 feet off the ground, I spotted two more in the distance on power lines. Apparently, to me, that looked like they were absorbing electricity of some way, because there was brilliant red lights with a purplish light in the center of it, a jerky sort of light coming back. It looked like it was going back to the ship, like they were drawing energy from the power lines. I thought it was doomsday. I really did. I didn't know what to expect after seeing two more in the field across from my house. I didn't know if it was an invasion or what.
When the object slowly moved away, Pekka raced back into the house to wake his family, hoping to get them away before it came back. Linda Pekka tells of the frantic activities that followed.
He was standing at the doorway screaming at me to get up. We got to get out of here. It's going to get us. And so I got up and I came down the hallway. The window shade was down. He pulled it back and he told me to look. And I looked out there and it was pitch black when I first looked. And by now he's got a hold of me and he's shaking me and he's screaming at me, which Bill doesn't scream. I mean, he's just hysterical is the way I can explain the way he was. And he keeps telling me we got to get the kids out of here. It's going to get us. And I didn't see anything. So I looked again and all of a sudden I saw this real, like a real bright light. And I still didn't know what I was looking at. I didn't know what had scared him. But after looking at the way he was and looking at what I saw, I knew I better listen to him. So I went down the hallway and grabbed my daughter. And I came back to the hallway and went out the front door. And he had grabbed our son by then. And he got to the front door and I heard him. He hollered, "Oh my God, it's going to see us." The power came back on. Apparently the TV set came back on. Here he's screaming, "It's going to get us." And he starts to pick up and he backs up. And when he puts it in reverse, the lights come on, the backup lights. And he's screaming again, "Oh my God, it's going to see us." So he took off down the road, no headlights on. And the light, I don't know whether it was from the moon or whether it was from this thing or what it was, but it was, I mean, you could see where you're going without the headlights on. But still, it scared him. He had the pickup going as fast as it could go. So we got to the railroad tracks, and he's screaming, "I got to get to Les's house." Les and Gail Aaron are friends of ours who, I don't know, maybe because they're the closest friends on that road, but he squealed in their driveway. And Gail was up. She told us later the power had gone off and her air conditioner was off.
Gail Aaron, the Pekka's neighbor, picks up the story.
Our puppy was new, and we'd only had him a couple days, and he was crying, so I got up to feed him. And when I got up, then I noticed our clock was out. We have a clock radio. And then I tried all the lights, and they were all out. And I glanced out the windows and noticed everything was really dark. And about the time I, you know, got back in the kitchen, then I heard this pickup driving very fast. And I thought it was just some kid fooling around like they usually do.
But Gail discovered she was wrong when she answered a knock on her front door.
Bill Pekka was at the door and yelling to me, "Look up in the sky." And he was kind of hysterical. Anyway, I looked up in the sky and there was this large object, round, reminded me of a cup and saucer, with a cup upside down, going through the sky, very bright light on the bottom. The whole top of it was, you couldn't see anything inside, but you could see the outline of the whole object. It was going through the sky, not really, it didn't seem to be going really fast. After a while, it just darted straight up in the air.
Both couples watched the huge object for some time, until it finally left, moving across the town of Colusa and then disappearing at a tremendous rate of speed. The electric power had been off for 9 minutes in Colusa and two other nearby areas that evening, and local utilities have still not been able to explain why. Close encounters of the second kind have drawn greater scientific interest simply because investigators have more to work with than just the testimony of witnesses. Again, Dr. Hynek.
Close encounters of the second kind were those in which there were some definite physical traces. In fact, we called them physical trace cases. The UFO, in those cases, interacted with the environment, either animate or inanimate, affecting animals, affecting machines and electrical circuits and so forth, and also affecting the ground. For instance, leaving burnt marks on the ground, holes in the ground, broken tree branches. In other words, physical effects that were directly associated with the reported craft.
Ted Phillips is a veteran UFO investigator who specializes in sightings where some physical trace of the incident is left. Close encounters of the second kind.
I think the physical trace landing cases give us the most direct approach to resolving the UFO problem, without question. Because we've compiled aerial observation, visual observations for 30 years. And they don't tell us that much. I mean, they tell us what the UFO looks like, how it acts at various speeds, colors, and so on. But what we need is something we can take into a laboratory.
One of Phillips' most interesting cases occurred on June 28, 1973, outside Columbia, Missouri. Just after midnight, James Richards, an employee of the University of Missouri, and his 16-year-old daughter, Ann, were preparing for bed in their trailer home on an isolated country road. Richards' 3-year-old son, Jamie, woke up and began to cry. The events that followed so frightened the Richards that Anne still refuses to discuss them. But James Richards remembers.
My daughter was going to the icebox refrigerator to get some milk for the baby. And she notices two bright lights, like spotlights. And then they converge into one big brown ball, illuminate the whole area with the trees swaying and well, it almost blind me because I couldn't look directly because it was too bright, like an eclipse. That's what I took it to see. So I looked at it on an angle, you might say, you see. And then, too, the trees were swaying. And then we heard outside this thrashing going around the tree. And so I got kind of shook, naturally. So I went and got my guns. I loaded them, and my daughter went and ran, locked the door. Something did snap in my mind, though, not to shoot. Because it's a rule, anytime I heard anything outside at night, the first thing I would do is get my flashlight and a gun. I don't care what it is. I'll go outside and start searching. But something clicked in my mind, said, don't go outside. Don't go outside. And I just left the guns there on top of the deep freeze and just looked out the window and just observed the best I could. You have to see it yourself to really have an idea of what I'm talking about. Because nothing I know of turns its colors, all different colors, beautiful colors, and do a 90-degree angle without making a sound. And hover there in space. And you sit there and look and all, you know. Boy, I said, my, it's pretty. But yet and still, you was frightened because you were dealing with something that you never seen before. You had no idea, you see. You didn't know what it was going to do any harm or what.
Members of the Richards family weren't the only ones affected by the presence of the strange craft.
I have a doghouse out there on that side. And them dogs scurry up under the building and stay till the whole event was over. They didn't bark at all. No siree.
With a feeling of relief, Richards watched as the light dimmed somewhat and began to ease away. But suddenly, it made a sharp turn and approached the trailer again.
When it came back up the second time, I felt like death was at hand. I figured this was it. And as soon as it touched down, then the whole area just lit up. See, you was actually blind. You see, but you could hear the thrash and the walk around this particular tree. Just this one tree now. Then my daughter said, look at the tree, look at the tree. Just pulling on the tree, pulling on the tree. And then next thing you heard the tree snap, that limb snap. And I tried to call out, call for help. This time my lights went completely out and came back on. She couldn't call out. The telephone line was dead. You didn't hear a buzz tone or anything. Could nobody call in? I couldn't call out. Just complete, like your wires were cut until they left.
In the course of his investigation of the Richards case, Ted Phillips spoke with the telephone operator who had traced the aborted emergency call.
I talked to the operator, contacted by the directory assistance operator, and she had been trying for 3 minutes to call Richards, but the line was indeed dead. Finally, suddenly, after she had tried 5 times, she broke through, and he was on the line. Well, when the police arrived, it was a young officer by himself. Richards told him what had happened, and he said the officer didn't seem to be too excited about going out into this darkened area. So they took a flashlight, they went over the fence, and sure enough, they found some imprints, which are about 5 inches long, about 3 inches wide, and about 2 to 2.5 inches into the ground. Now, I have to point out that the next day, a newspaper reporter was out there. He picked it up from the police blotter. And this reporter weighs about 350 pounds, and he could barely make a heel mark in the ground. It was that dry, that hard. So we're talking about considerable weight. At the site, then, I found this series, this pattern of imprints down through there. The tree limb, which was twisted and pulled down, stripped down at a point 12 and a half feet above the ground. And several other broken limbs. We arrived there a week after the event, and leaves were absolutely burnt, very badly burnt, down in the lower regions where the UFO had been. And leaves on the limbs some 40, 45 feet up in the air above this area were starting to die.
That big tree is completely dead today. The Richards have since moved to a new home surrounded by plenty of neighbors. But their hope of finding an answer for what they saw that night in June remains empty. The most intriguing types of UFO experiences, called close encounters of a third kind by Dr. Hynek, are those involving contact with humanoid occupants.
Close encounters of the third kind are those in which creatures, entities, beings, humanoids, ufonauts, call them what you will, were reported in direct association with the sighted craft.
Just after sunset, on the evening of November 5, 1975, a seven-man crew was piling into a four-wheel drive vehicle after finishing a day of woodcutting near the tiny northern Arizona community of Snowflake. One of the seven men was Travis Walton, whose curiosity that night plunged him into a living nightmare he would never forget. Just before leaving the work area, the men in the Jeep watched a glowing object emerge from behind the trees. Travis opened a door to get a better view and continued watching, stunned, with his companions.
The thing was about 90 feet away, about 20 feet in diameter, about 8 feet high. It was glowing, a golden color, kind of like molten metal. I couldn't hear anything at first. It must have been because when I got closer, I could hear it, but it was a high-pitched, intermittent sound and a low rumbling sound. It sounded like machinery or, you know, a heavy mechanical sound. Very difficult to describe.
Travis got out of the vehicle and moved toward the object, despite cries from his friends for him to return. Walton assumed by the time he could get any closer, the object would be gone.
Just as I got up close, it started to move with a sort of a rocking motion, kind of like a spinning top, you know, like when it's slowing down to fall over, except it wasn't spinning. It the same side stayed toward me, and when it started to move, it got real loud, and that really scared me. And I jumped down behind a log, and I looked up at this thing, and I decided then I was in a lot of danger, and I was going to get the heck out of there. And I raised up to go. It's the last thing I remember. I raised up and I started to turn. And I was just about in a high crouch when, wham, I felt a numbing shock hit me. It kind of like in the head. And I went out. I was knocked unconscious.
His six co-workers, however, saw what Travis had not. A slender beam of intense light which shot from the craft and lifted Walton off his feet, knocking him to the ground. The rest of the crew sped away in panic, looking back to see the craft take off. But when they returned to see if Travis was all right, he was nowhere to be found. When Travis finally came to, he was weak, groggy, and in pain. Above him was a light. He assumed he was in a hospital bed, but as his blurred vision became clearer, he discovered he was wrong.
I felt something pressing on my chest. My shirt and my jacket pushed up, and there was this thing laying across it. It was about 4 or 5 inches thick. The thing extended down over my rib cage and down to my belt. And when I looked up and I saw this thing, it was gray. And I looked past the edge of it and I saw something white. My eyes weren't focusing real good, and at first I thought it was a doctor, you know, white mask and cap. But when I got to where I could see, I saw this thing, and I just came unglued. I looked around me, and there was three of them. I just panicked. I became hysterical.
As his eyes became accustomed to the surroundings, Travis saw his captors in more detail.
They were about 4 feet 10. Had very large heads. No hair on their heads, no eyebrows, no whiskers or anything like that. They had very large eyes. Those eyes are something that really bothered me worse than anything. The rest of their features were small. It was like small ears, small nose, small mouth, hardly any lips if they had any lips. I never saw them open their mouth, but they were wearing a long coverall type things. They were orangish tan. When I saw them, I struck out. I just, well, I wasn't really, a blow. I was so weak, I pushed this one on my right, and he fell back into another one. They felt kind of marshmallowy, kind of like fat, you know. Whereas, you know, when you push against somebody with muscle, it feels differently. But they seemed light, unexpectedly. And I jumped off the table there and staggered over into the corner. There was a bench across the wall, and I leaned there. And I was really weak, and I was so scared, you know, I was shaking, and they started towards me. And I started just screaming at them, you know, telling them to keep away from me. And I reached over and I grabbed a thing off of the table. There was some bunch of things there, and there was a clear tube about maybe an inch in diameter, I don't know, a foot and a half long. And I thought, it wasn't heavy like glass, it was too light for a club, so I wanted to defend myself, and so I hit it against the table to break it, you know, maybe get a sharp point, but it didn't break. But I lashed out at them with it, and I kept screaming. They only took a couple of steps, and they stopped.
After the creatures departed, Travis left the room through the same door, but went down the hallway in the opposite direction.
I came to a doorway on my right, and I went into this. I didn't go right in. I looked in, and it was a round room, a domed room, with a chair in the middle. And it's really funny about this room. It's really strange. It looked like, you know, I could see the walls and everything, the same as there were everything else in that place. It was all just this matte gray metal look. But when I went towards the chair, I didn't go towards the chair right away. I walked around towards the side because the chair was high-backed, and I was afraid that there might be one of those things sitting in that chair. So I went around there, and when I could see that there was nobody in the chair, I walked over to it. But the closer I got to the chair, the darker the room seemed. And I could start seeing points of light, like the stars. There was buttons there. You know, I did a stupid thing. I pushed some, hoping to open the door or something. But when that didn't work, well, I got scared of doing that too, because it made the stars move. I turned, and there was a man standing in the door where I came through. And this guy, I mean, he appeared human to me. You know, which was a big relief, and I ran up there and started asking him all kinds of questions, and just smiled, kind of tolerant-like, and I assumed that maybe he couldn't hear me because he had the helmet on his head, a clear helmet. And so when he motioned for me, and he took me by the arm, I went with him. I assumed I was being rescued.
Travis was led out of the craft and into a large hangar, where more human-like figures were present. He remembers their appearance this way.
They'd pass, you know, on the street, but they had a strange thing to their eyes that were a light color, light, a golden hazel, you know? And they had a resemblance to each other, like a family, but not identical. There was one of them that was a woman, I could tell. Had longer hair, female shape. One of the men and the woman came over there, and they put me on the table, and they put a mask over my face, and I started to resist, and they held me on the table, and they put this mask on my face, and I reached up to pull it away, and before I could, everything went black.
Meanwhile, the other members of the woodcutting crew had reported Walton missing. Local police organized a search party, but no trace of Walton was found. The next thing he remembered, Travis was lying on the side of a road outside Heber, Arizona, 12 miles from Snowflake.
When I first regained consciousness, I was laying on the roadway, well, to the side of the road, more off than on, and my head was on my arm, and I saw a light, and I looked up in time to see it go off, which I think was either a light going off or a hatch closing, perhaps. Then I saw this object hovering there. It was a flattened sphere. I mean, it was shaped like a disc, but it was very shiny, chrome-like. I could see that reflecting everything around there, but not giving off any light. It was dark. And it was just there for a second, hovering about 4 feet off the ground. and then it just shot straight up. It was incredible how quick, without making a sound.
Travis staggered to a phone booth to call his family, who at first did not believe it was really him. But once convinced, they came to take him home. On the way, Travis received yet another shock.
We were riding back in, and they said something about everybody being worried about me. I can't remember the exact conversation, but I said, well, you know, it must have been a bad couple of hours or something, to reference to time or something like that. And they said, Travis, you've been gone for 5 days.
While recuperating, Travis was able to remember most of what had happened to him. A series of hypnotic regressions with Dr. James Harder from the University of California, however, enabled Walton to recall things with less anxiety and more detail. What you are about to hear is a rare edited portion of one of those hypnotic sessions, in which Travis Walton offers a chilling recollection of his face-to-face encounter with his abductors.
You can describe what he looks like to us and it won't bother you. It's just like you were trying to describe something for someone who was going to draw something.
He's ugly.
You can describe what he looks like to us and it won't bother you.
He looks so white. He looks soft. Rubbery. Looks Chinese.
Do you get a picture of what the eyes look like?
He look at me. I look at his eyes. They're big round eyes. They move.
Can you see what color they might be?
Brown.
Take a good look at the pupil. Can you tell me what the pupil looks like?
Only horses have eyes like that.
Because of its sensational nature, UFO debunkers have singled out the Travis Walton case for criticism. They have accused him of everything from describing an LSD trip to telling an outright lie. In an attempt to resolve the controversy, investigative research associates sought the expertise of former military intelligence officer Charles R. McQuiston. During World War II, McQuiston and a fellow officer developed a prototype of a revolutionary new truth test called Psychological Stress Evaluation, or PSE. The PSE instrument measures tiny nerve impulses from the brain, which are transmitted to a person's vocal cords. Using a tape recorder at slow speed, a moving needle translates the voice impulses onto a narrow strip of paper, similar to a lie detector or a hospital electrocardiogram. Police departments in several states are using PSE instead of traditional lie detectors, which many times register artificial stress due to anxiety produced by the test itself. Charles McQuiston discusses the result of his PSE evaluation of Travis Walton.
I have run the subject Walton on some 30 charts to ascertain certain basic things. Number one, I think the prime consideration is any possibility of a hoax on the part of Walton in the story that he is telling. I have noticed several indications of what may well be embellishment of facts on the part of the subject, but in no way do they interfere with my impression that he really believes what he is saying. I think that it's a simple case of the story having been retold many times, and it has been polished as it has been told. In other words, I think he's trying to be as accurate as he can, but he is putting in words that would not necessarily have been there the first time that he told the story. He is under varying degrees of stress, ranging from extreme stress almost to the panic point in describing certain traumatic elements of this experience, and I don't think this would be possible if it was any kind of a hoax being perpetrated on his part. Whether, in fact, it happened at all, or to the degree that he says it did, is really irrelevant in terms of this instrumentation, because I can only tell you whether or not he really believes what he's saying, and I believe that he does, that he is sincere.
Dr. Hynek summarizes the Walton controversy.
I've always divided the Travis Walton case, in my own mind, into two parts. The first, which involved six witnesses who were given lie detector tests, five of whom completed it successfully, and the sixth was inconclusive but not negative. That part of the story fits a very definite pattern. The sighting of a brilliantly illuminated object, which was hovering not too far from the ground, all of that fits. The second part, the actual abduction of Travis Walton, of course, we have only his word for this, but the story does hang together, and it is unusual in that the time lapse was so long, 5 days, whereas in most of the abduction cases, the time lapse and the time aboard, so to speak, is a matter of minutes or hours. Further, the rigorous analysis given the psychological stress evaluation test by Mr. McQuiston seems to indicate that Walton is indeed telling the truth.
Father William Gill is an ordained priest of the Church of England. On June 25, 1959, Father Gill and dozens of his native parishioners at the Papua Mission in New Guinea witnessed an aerial phenomenon that to this day defies logical explanation. The strange object they saw hung in the air hundreds of feet above the ground for almost 4 hours, according to Father Gill.
You could describe it, I suppose, as a circular ship with a kind of deck and bridge on the top. A big circular ship which wouldn't be very far removed from one's idea of a hovercraft, but no noise. It was a dull yellow, a bright orange-y colour. It wasn't as though the thing was itself lit up all around. It was more as though some other light was lighting it up. It didn't look as though it was like an electric light bulb, the light coming from within. And then all around the whole object was a sparkling effect.
The following night, the strange object returned. And this time, Father Gill, along with 38 Papuans, noticed what appeared to be the silhouettes of occupants aboard the craft peering down at them.
When we saw this object, and we saw figures on it, moving about, trying to do something, one of the natural reactions would be to wave. And this is what I did. I waved with one hand, and a figure seemed to wave with one hand back, with one arm. And then Ananias, the teacher standing next to me, he waved in the same sort of fashion, waving his arms across. And again, a figure seemed to do the same. It seemed as though this figure was bending over a deck or a rail of a ship and simply responding to our waves. We couldn't make out any details of face or whether they had hair or anything like that. It was more as though they were in a diving suit. I sent Eric, one of the schoolboys, down to the house for a flashlight to see if we could getting acknowledgement with a flashlight. We flashed the torch on and off, and it just seemed as though to us that the whole of the ship moved sideways as a pendulum, not very much, but just a little to the right and then a little to the left, as though it was acknowledging the flashes of the torch. And that ceased after about half a minute. The next major event was when we tried to encourage it to land. We beckoned, but it didn't, and the creatures on board seemed to lose all interest in us. They seemed to be more intent on working on whatever they were doing. This is assuming they were working, but it appeared to us that they were doing something on the deck, fixing something or doing something, and they seemed to be more interested in that than us. When it did disappear, it seemed to disappear to very quickly, in that it either went off very quickly, so that in a matter of half a second or so, it was a large craft, which one might imagine about 30-odd feet in diameter, down to a pinhead and nothing, all within about half a second.
Dr. J. Allen Hynek traveled to Papua New Guinea to personally investigate Father Gill's sighting.
I was successful in finding 6 of the original native witnesses who confirmed the story. I think one of the highlights of that whole event was the fact that Father Gill and the natives did not take it too seriously when it was happening. In fact, Father Gill told me when he was a guest at my home that he felt it might have been some strange new device of you Americans, as he put it. I thanked him for the compliment, but I assured him that we Americans did not have any device that could hover several hundred feet in the air silently and then take off at a rapid speed.
2:25 a.m., December 3rd, 1967. Ashland, Nebraska police officer Herbert Schirmer radioed a call for help to the sheriff's dispatcher in the nearby community of Wahoo.
408 Wahoo, 408 Wahoo, there's an object in front of me with red flashing lights. I'm getting closer. The object is taking form. It's of a disc-shaped. 408 Wahoo, I need some help down here. I don't know what it is. It's moving over the left shoulder of the road.
The sheriff's department never picked up another transmission from Schirmer. And because the nearest patrol unit was at the opposite end of the county, Schirmer was left alone at the intersection of Highways 6 and 63 to face the unknown.
The radio went dead. There was a flash of white light came from the object that has moved to the left shoulder of the road, and it seemed as if the vehicle and myself were being pulled to the left shoulder of the highway. The next thing I remember, I was up on the embankment in the field, standing outside the patrol car by the driver's side, watching this large object, legs retract, like a tripod retracting. There was like a catwalk around the outside of the craft, which was spinning, and there was an orange reddish glow coming from beneath it, giving off a real brightness, whistling sound, and it seemed to just lift up and then shoot directly out of sight.
As he compiled his official report of the incident, Schirmer realized he could not account for almost 30 minutes of his time. After passing four state police lie detector tests, the missing time remained a mystery. Hypnosis provided the answer.
When the flash of light came from the object, the vehicle was pulled with a force up the embankment where the craft landed. A hatch opened up from the underside of the craft. A tube came down. And a platform slid down. This, I call it a ladder. So this being comes down and walks over to the front of the patrol car with a black object in his hands. And it seems as he presses it, a green, flashy, like mist, sprays over the vehicle. I can't move. I can't do nothing. I'm just looking. Another being walks to the driver's side of the patrol car. My window was rolled about halfway down. The reason for that was to hear noises at nighttime when you're cruising real slow. He reached inside the window, and in his, I'd say his right hand, he had a shiny object he depressed against the side of my neck, which gave a tingling sensation down my neck, spine, into my legs. He opened up the vehicle door. I stepped out, and he says to me, "Are you the watchman of this town?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." And he says, "Watchman, come with me."
Schirmer described the aliens as almost human in appearance, recalling in particular the one he believed to be the leader.
I would say that his flesh tone would look like a man who'd been out in the desert and really copper tone burned and shaven where it looked gray textured, you know. It would look like that. He had a very small mouth. His mouth didn't move. He seemed like he spoke with a deep voice. You know, like a person talks real deep voice, he'd bring everything out. He spoke like that. The fellow, it seemed like they were talking with the telecommunication. He was about 5.5 feet tall, maybe 5'7". Broad-shouldered, muscular. His age appeared, I'd say, about, at that time I was 21 years old, I would say to me at that time he looked to be about 50, 45, 50. He had a large forehead, long nose, he had heavy dark eyebrows. His eyes were the same as our eyes would be, except for the pupil of his eyes were slit like a cat's. There was a hood covering his head like he had on a jumpsuit. and it was sort of a silverish grayish color. One side of his head was sort of like a lump, like a black box there with a small antenna sticking out of it. On the other side, you could see the form of the ear. He had on a black belt, black gloves, and black boots. And he seemed to have sort of like a holster, a black holster on the side of his hip, which I couldn't tell what was in it. And on his left side of his uniform was a diamond-shaped patch with a winged dragon on the patch. Each one of them had one.
Shermer was then led up the ladder and into the craft.
The first level of the craft that we were in was a large circular room with large, like 55-gallon drums, canisters all the way around this room, with like a brass cable weaved through the top. And in the center of the room was computers, a couple of platforms, and the overhead ceiling was a large cone-shaped object which was spinning, floating freely in the center of the room, giving off a sort of a very light reddish glow. And I said, "What is this?" And he said, "This is how our craft operates." And I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "By reversible electrical magnetism. One of the purposes for us landing here was to extract electricity from your power source." And he says, "Follow me." And we walked over and out of one of the port holes, this one pressing buttons, and a blue boat shot out to the pole. It seemed like for about 60 seconds. Then it came back again. The boat came back again, like for about 60 seconds. And then it quit.
He was then taken to the craft's second level, which he estimated to have been at least 40 feet above the ground.
There was a large, the same size as the other room, but many, all kinds of computers, charts, graphs. There was like a large screen. We walked directly over to that. As we were walking, I noted that there was another being opposite of him at a panel. And he pressed some buttons and he showed a group of stars off in the distance and said, "This is where we are from, a galaxy next to your galaxy." Watchman, he says, "One day, you yourself will see the universe as I have seen it." And told me that I would not speak wisely of what I've seen or what I heard when I left. And then he escorted me outside of the craft to my vehicle, where I turned and he touched my shoulder and I touched him, and then I knew that there was a real sensation there. He went back to his craft and took off.
There had been a 5-minute power failure in Ashland, Nebraska that night. In addition, a charred power pole was found about 200 yards from the landing site. Its transformer burned out. 9 other people reported sighting a strange light in the sky that evening, but Herbert Shermer took the brunt from skeptics and debunkers. He was eventually forced to leave the town in which he had grown up. Because there are no known witnesses to corroborate Shermer's testimony, we turn to PSE expert Charles R. McQuiston.
We have about 15 charts up there, and as I said, I can't find any holes in his story. This is by far the most specific instance in terms of details, like the patch, the arm patch, and the winged dragon. And usually these people don't go into such specific detail, but he does it, so I have to believe his story, because there's nothing in the charts that would refute what he's saying.
January 6, 1976. Elaine Thomas and Louise Smith had treated their friend Mona Stafford to a birthday dinner at a restaurant 30 miles from their homes in Liberty, Kentucky. Around 11:15 p.m., as they were driving back, they became dizzy. Their heads ached miserably. Looking up, they were horrified to see a huge, brightly colored circular object hovering over their car. Louise Smith lost control of the vehicle. And the next thing they knew, it was almost 2 hours later, and they were 12 miles further down the road. When they returned home, Louise Smith noticed a burn mark on her neck.
And my neck was burning. Oh, it was hurting so bad, you know. And I asked Mona to look at my neck. And then we all got to comparing, you know, because we were all burning and hurting, you know. And Mona's eyes, they were something terrible. So we looked at our necks, you know. I looked at Mona's and all. We each had a mark on our neck about 3 inches long and an inch wide. That just the top layer of skin looked like it had been removed. So I looked at my watch to see what time it was. And the minute hand was going as fast as the second hand should have been going, completely malfunctioning. I picked up my alarm clock and it starts doing the same thing. Everything I touched went haywire, you know. And when I went into the bathroom and started to wash, I burned just like, well, it was almost like I was scalding myself, you know, from the heat. And so we did go to the doctor, and he told us that we definitely was exposed to something like radiation that could have been the reason for the burning, for the hurting in Mona's eyes, you know, and all of this.
Dr. Leo Sprinkle, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Wyoming, heard about the experience and agreed to try hypnotic regression on the women to help them recall the time for which they could not account. Listen closely to this exclusive portion of Dr. Sprinkle's original hypnotic interview with Louise Smith, and note her anguish as she relives the experience.
It was right over.
It was right over you? Okay. Okay.
What is it? Oh. It looks like it's going to crash. God, what is it?
Didn't know what it was. It was really frightening. And what happens now?
I don't want to look at it no more.
So frightening, it's hard to look at?
Yeah. I'm so bright. My eyes hurt.
The light hurts your eyes?
Leonard Stringfield, a former Air Force UFO investigator, now affiliated with the Mutual UFO Network, was present for several of the hypnotic sessions.
The contortions and the crying that these women showed, you know, during the hypnosis, and it would make a believer out of you.
It took Dr. Sprinkle several tries at regression to extract the terrifying details of the missing minutes. Louise Smith ultimately remembered waking up on what seemed to be an operating table with strange creatures peering down at her.
They were about 4 to 4.5 feet tall, and they wore a dark, tight-fitted suit and a hood. The hood was tight-fitted also, you know. The only thing visible was the eyes. They were very huge and pointed more to the temple, not straight across like our eyes would be. There was an odor. It was almost like a mold. Have you ever smelled a refrigerator that's been fastened up that with no electric for a long time, you know? And you open that door and you get this kind of moldy smell. I smell that. And I have never been asked this question, but now is an opportunity to bring this out also. The odor itself I smelled stronger when the beings were near me. And when they looked at me, we did not talk verbally like we're talking now. It was a telepathy type thing. And I would tell myself I'm not going to look at them. But there was no way I could resist, you know. And then at one point, they poured a liquid over my entire body. And I thought I was going to die because I could not breathe. I could not breathe, and it was so hot, you know. So then when they pulled it off, it was like ripping a piece of tape, you know, from the body and the skin. And what that was for, other than I get so frightened, I think maybe they were making a mold, you know.
Dr. Sprinkle sums up the questions raised by the Kentucky abduction case.
Are they physically real? Are they psychologically real? Or both? We know they're psychologically real in the sense that the persons have described events which are significant to them and which have caused some changes in their lives. Whether they are physically real, the evidence suggests that. For example, burn marks on the back of the neck of the women, symptoms, loss of weight, sleeplessness, irritability or arousal of anxiety. So we know that they are experiencing physiologically some stimulus. What we don't know is, does that mean that they were taken on aboard a flying saucer and examined physically, or were they psychologically programmed to have that kind of experience?
Psychological stress evaluation expert Charles R. McQuiston has meticulously analyzed the actual witness testimony of the close encounter cases you have just heard. Here are his final conclusions.
None of these cases that I've run would indicate anything like a hoax to me. A couple of them were pretty liberal in their translation of their experience. In that degree, you might say, well, it's partially a hoax because it isn't completely the truth. The one common factor is that they have all experienced an extraordinary thing. And some of the things done to most of these people in terms of alien contact, touching, feeling, and the discomfort of mental communication, as they describe it, are pretty graphic to them. And they have described this in varying degrees. We have a wide range of personalities here. We have a fairly wide range of intellect and formal education. Yet, in their own fashion, they are describing what they believe to be true.
An incident which is perhaps one of the most widely publicized and well-known close encounter cases involved Betty Hill and her late husband Barney. The Hill case has become a classic example of alleged extraterrestrial contact with human beings because it contains elements which are still the subject of heated debate among UFO investigators all over the world. On the 19th of September, 1961, as Betty and Barney Hill were driving in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, they saw a distant point of light which seemed to move erratically. As it moved closer, the light became more intense, Betty Hill remembers.
When we reached what is called the Indian Head area, this craft left the top of the mountain, came out of the highway, and stopped in midair. Barney took the binoculars and started out of the car in an attempt to identify the craft. And as he did this, he saw a group of figures standing in the windows looking down at him. One was saying to him, "Don't be afraid. Keep looking. Keep looking. Stay there. Don't be afraid. No harm's going to come to you, but stay there." And the craft started to descend. And Barney ran back to the car, saying we had to get out of there. They were going to capture us. And we took off speeding down the highway. There was a series of beeping sounds.
That was all the Hills could remember about the incident when they finally arrived home, but they both had an uneasy feeling that there was something more. Months passed, but life was not the same for the Hills. Barney suffered recurring headaches. They were tense, upset, couldn't sleep. Finally, they took their troubles to a Boston psychiatrist, Benjamin Simon, who used hypnotic regression to discover the root cause of their distress.
We relived where the ones on the craft were now on the ground, blocking, so we couldn't drive. Barney put on the brakes, the car motor died. They separated, came up on each side, took us out, took us in a path through the woods, took us on board, gave us physical examinations. We were being kidnapped.
Betty Hill remembers being able to offer a detailed description of her alien abductors.
They're all shot. The leader, I would say, was my height, or just a little taller than I am, and I'm 5 foot. They all had dark uniforms. I shouldn't say uniform. All had a one-piece dark clothing on. And some were wearing jackets, and some were wearing caps, others were not. They were bald, no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes, and no earlobes, no ear, you know, we could see. Very large eyes, very small flat nose, thin slit for mouth.
Dr. Simon was astounded by Betty's hypnotic recall of the alleged abduction, mainly because Barney told him essentially the same incredible story in a separate hypnotic interview. Simon felt the possibility of a hoax was remote. The Hills had obviously undergone a traumatic experience, but was it real or an illusion? Betty Hill describes her experience aboard the craft.
I was shown a star map. When he showed me the map, he said, "Do you know where you are on the map?" And I said, "No, I don't." So I assume he meant our sun and planets. He also said the heavy lines on the map were places they went all the time. The lighter lines were places they went occasionally or frequently. The broken lines were expeditions. And of course, our own sun system was a place where they go frequently or occasionally.
Through a post-hypnotic suggestion, Betty reproduced the star map. Years later, an Ohio school teacher, Marjorie Fish, saw the map and began a tedious attempt to verify its accuracy.
Since the map was apparently drawn from the vantage point of the ufonauts and not from Earth, it had to be checked out by way of a model rather than using just our sky maps. And so I started to get information on how to build and started building models of the nearby star systems. I built about 22 models in all. When Betty claims to have seen the map, it was 1961. When she drew the map, it was 1964. The original data I worked with were catalogs from 1963 and 1964, and I was not able to find the whole pattern. I did get a large part of the pattern, but I couldn't fit in the last three that had lines to or any of the background stars. And when the 1969 Gliese catalog came out, then the last three stars fell into place, plus the background stars, and Betty could not possibly have drawn that map from anything that she had seen or could have used at the time that she drew the map as a hoax. Also, she doesn't have the astronomy knowledge to do so. And again, it could not have been a hoax by anyone else on Earth at that time.
According to Betty Hill's map, the lines representing what she called trade routes converged on a pair of stars known as Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. They are barely visible to the naked eye, and those living in the northern hemisphere can't see them at all. Their estimated distance from Earth is just over 37 light years. Stanton Friedman, physicist and noted UFO lecturer, says that according to Einstein's theory of relativity, 37 light years would be much shorter for those traveling aboard a craft than for those left behind.
What Einstein really said is not only that things can't go faster than the speed of light, and he put it in a much more technical fashion than that, but that as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, time slows down for the things moving that fast. So that, for example, at 99.9% of the speed of light, you could go a 37 light year distance, forgetting the acceleration time for a moment, in 20 months pilot time. Now, if you really crank up the engine, put her in sixth gear or something, and go 99.99% of the speed of light, it would only take 6 months pilot time for a one-way trip of a distance of 37 light years. It's mind-boggling, sure, but it's real.
Betty Hill's star map is probably the most convincing evidence of alien visitors to Earth thus far. Dr. Hynek summarizes the Hill case.
Now, what many commentators seem to have missed in this star map situation, and which makes the case truly unique, is that the lines connecting certain stars that were drawn by Betty Hill, who by her own admission knew little of astronomy, just happened to connect only those stars that, like the sun, are capable of supporting life on a nearby planet. The odds against this happening purely by chance are staggering, especially when one considers that Of the 1,000 stars in the solar neighborhood, only 48 fall into this category.
Finally, the Air Force has confirmed that a UFO was tracked on radar in the vicinity of New Hampshire's White Mountains on the night of the Hills abduction. One of the most perplexing questions which remains unanswered is whether the American government knows more about the UFO phenomenon than it's telling. Former CIA employee Brad Ayers, now with the Center for UFO Studies, thinks the immense bureaucratic machinery is making it nearly impossible for the public to find out.
I've found, although I've listened to hundreds of stories and a lot of allegations, I found no hard evidence that the government is deliberately repressing information about UFOs. I think that a lot of what is attributed to a repression of information or the suppression of information is reduced to just simple bureaucratic ineptness and red tape.
What about the possibility that there is indeed physical evidence of extraterrestrial visitations to Earth, perhaps locked away in the dark vaults of government secrecy? Astronaut Gordon Cooper is among several authorities who are unwilling to dismiss the theory as pure fiction. Cooper himself has heard rumors of crash saucers recovered by the military.
There was some accident involving a UFO, and from there it varies greatly. There were occupants in each of the rumors that I've heard, but from there on it varies greatly as to whether they were all alive or some alive, or what the extent of damage was to them, and then as to what happened to them is quite variable. The particular rumors aren't necessarily from people who've been involved, but they come from so many different sources that it would lead you to believe that it certainly is worth investigating a little further. My personal feeling all along has been that I feel that the government should be honest with the citizens of the United States, and I think they really underestimate the intelligence level of the citizens of the country by continually hiding things from them.
Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Over the years, these rumors have persisted. Hardly a week goes by without my being asked about the crashed saucer stories. My response to these rumors has always been complete skepticism. Recently, however, some of my colleagues, investigative research associates, have probed into these stories, and some intriguing information has surfaced. I believe it is quite worthwhile to let listeners to this record have the benefit of some preliminary findings. In any event, a rather dramatic story has developed. It starts with the following affidavit of one Lieutenant Colonel Robert B. Willingham.
Down at Dice Air Force Base in Texas, we were testing what turned out to be the F-94s. They reported on the scope that they had an unidentified flying object flying at a high speed going to intercept our course. It became visible to us. And we watched it, and we wanted to take after it, but headquarters wouldn't let us go after it. And it played around a little bit, and then we got to watching how it made 90-degree turns at this high speed and everything. We knew it wasn't a missile of any type.
Willingham's sighting occurred late in 1948, but he remained silent about the experience for nearly 30 years, deciding only recently to forsake an oath of secrecy in the public interest for this investigation. When the incident took place, the UFO was originally tracked by a chain of radar stations along the Arctic Circle called the Dew Line, part of North America's air defense system.
So then we conferred it with the radar control station on the Dew Line, and they kept following it, and they claimed that it crashed somewhere down off from the, between Texas and old Mexico border. And we got a light aircraft, me and my co-pilot, and we went down to the site, and we landed out in the pasture right across from where it hit at. So we got over there, they told us to leave and everything else, and then the armed guards come out, and they started forming a line around the area. So on the way back, I seen a little piece of metal, so I picked it up and brought it back with me. There were two sand mounds that came down, and it looked to me like this thing crashed right in between them, but it went into the ground according to the way the people were acting around it. So we actually never did get right up to the site to see what had crashed. But you could see for, oh, I'd say probably 300 to 500 feet where it had went across the sand, like in there. And it looked to me like, I guess, from the metal that we found, chunks of metal, that he either had a little explosion or it began to disintegrate or something caused this metal to come apart, you know.
After they had left the crash site, Willingham and his co-pilot examined the piece of metal and found it to possess unusual qualities.
It looked like it was something made because it was honeycombed. You know how you make metal for where it will cool faster? In a way, it looked like a magnesium steel, but it had a lot of carbon in it because I tried to heat it with a cutting torch and it just wouldn't melt. A cutting torch with acetylene and oxygen burns at anywhere from 32 to 3800 degrees Fahrenheit. And it would make the metal hot, but it wouldn't even start to make it yield.
Willingham took the material to a Marine Corps metallurgy lab in Hagerstown, Maryland for analysis. Several days later, he was told that the man he had contacted there had never worked for the lab and that no one else there knew anything about the piece of metal. Willingham adds this postscript.
Well, at that time, all unidentified flying objects, anybody that reported one through the Air Force, had to be debriefed on it. Even the radar operators were debriefed on what they had followed on the screens. We were not to even discuss it among the pilots that had seen it, that had been on this mission. We weren't even discussing it among ourselves. We signed papers that we would not discuss it with nobody.
Investigative Research Associates, with the help of former National Security Agency intelligence specialist Todd Zeckel, traced a former aide to an Army general who claimed to have been shown a crashed saucer, which was reportedly being stored and studied at a Virginia military installation in the mid-1960s. Herbert Coyer was a student at a southern university where the one-time general's aide is currently employed. Coyer remembers the incredible account related to him by the former aide in front of two other witnesses who have both confirmed that the conversation did indeed take place.
The story began with a crash of a flying saucer, a small vessel approximately 12 to 13 feet across, in White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico in 1951. Outside of the vessel, I found one small being in a spacesuit of sorts, approximately 3 to 3.5 feet tall. It was humanoid. The only main difference between them and us, aside from size, was larger eyes. The eyes were noticeably larger. They followed two sets of tracks approximately a mile beyond the ship and found two more beings, also dead. These were taken to Langley Field in Virginia. He toured Langley, and as part of this tour, they were shown this vessel, one other ship of the same size. They saw the three beings, one of which they had performed an autopsy on, and internally, he said they were basically the same as human beings inside. It seems to stick in my mind that one of them was preserved. The vessel had a one-foot discrepancy between the inner and outer wall that they could not account for. There were no moving parts, no controls of any kind inside the ship, just chairs back to back. And that was it. No means of control, no means of power they could find. And as of the time I heard the story, they had not been able to cut in any way the surface of the ship either.
That astounding story, told to Coyer by the general's aide, remains unproven. But each conversation we had with the aide and other individuals allegedly involved directly with crash saucers had one common denominator, as Dr. Hynek explains.
During the many conversations all of us had with the military officers said to have been involved in some way with the crashed saucer incident, they never directly confirmed their stories. But more significantly, each individual also refused to deny his involvement, even after having been given numerous opportunities to do so. Why couldn't they have gotten us off their backs simply by saying the rumors were not true? This they would not do, leading me to believe that these people are indeed fearful to speak candidly about their experiences, whatever they might have been.
Crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft on Earth, recovered by American military officials, and currently in storage somewhere in the United States. truth or fantasy. President Carter had this to say about the issue of public access to UFO information during the 1976 presidential campaign.
I don't see any reason to keep information like that secret, but there may be some aspects of the UFO information that, with which I'm not familiar, that might be related to some secret experiments that we were doing that might involve our national security or new weapon systems. I certainly wouldn't release that. But if it was something removed from our national security, you know, in my opinion as president, I would go ahead and release it. I see nothing wrong with that.
Meanwhile, investigative research associates and the Center for UFO Studies will continue to seek the final answer and would welcome any new information which will be held in the strictest confidence. You have now heard the evidence. The witnesses have stated their cases. Now, the experts draw their conclusions. Stanton Friedman represents one point of view.
I'm convinced that the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled vehicles from off the Earth. In other words, it's some UFOs or somebody else's spacecraft. Let's face it, we've only had technology for a lousy 100 years. What if somebody got started just a tiny bit before we did on his technological kick? I mean, what the heck? We've increased our top speed for moving people around 1,000 times over what we could do just 100 years ago. We live in a system that's 5 billion years old, our solar system. So if a guy gets started just a tiny bit, what's that, 100 years? He could be 1,000 times faster than we are, using techniques about which we know nothing.
Many experts feel that there is too little evidence to warrant jumping to that conclusion. Dr. Hynek explains one alternative theory that we might be dealing with something from another dimension.
One of the most intriguing aspects of UFO sightings is their apparent isolation in space and time. Sightings are usually made in one place at a time and last for short periods, sometimes appearing out of nowhere and vanishing into nowhere. This is much more suggestive of a parallel reality than, let's say, visits from some faraway planet, in which case we might expect them to stick around for a while.
And there are those who say the phenomenon is a product of fertile imaginations. UFO researcher Dr. Jacques Vallée sees a great danger if governments and scientists continue to dismiss it in this manner.
I'm afraid of the credibility gap of science with respect to this phenomenon, because you have millions of people who, rightly or wrongly, believe they've seen UFOs. You're talking about thousands of people to whom the phenomenon has become personally important in their lives, and these people have nobody to talk to. They can't talk to the military, they can't talk to the police, they can't talk to scientists. Nobody will look at that kind of data. And I think that we as scientists have a responsibility to those people.
Computer science is being used to separate fact from fiction in dealing with UFO reports. Dr. David Saunders, with the help of the Center for UFO Studies, heads up Project UFOCAT, a computerized system which processes and analyzes the thousands of UFO sightings reported each year.
It turns out that certain areas produce more and certain areas produce fewer. You start to ask why, and you uncover the fact that the areas producing more than their share are better educated, which comes as a surprise to some people. And after that, you might uncover the fact that an area in which there is better visibility, seeing conditions, produces more than its share, which comes as a surprise if you don't think there's anything to it.
Once again, Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
The idea of other intelligences in space is not so radical or new. It's in both the ancient Eastern religions and the more modern faiths. The prophets in the Bible and many philosophers have been telling us for centuries that there are other planes of existence. So why do we find it so difficult to acknowledge that there might be other highly developed life forms or forms of consciousness that might surpass our own? In fact, it is now widely accepted that the universe may well be teeming with life.
The National Aeronautics and Space Administration has shown great reluctance to enter the arena of UFO investigating. And yet, ironically, NASA saw fit to include an unusual and significant recording aboard the Voyager 1 and 2 exploratory probes on their intergalactic missions to Jupiter, Saturn, and beyond. The introduction to the two-hour recording is by Kurt Waldheim.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.